everybody, and welcome to Raising the Future. And we're very happy to have Professor Peter Gray with us. Hello, Peter. He is an American psychologist who currently occupies the position of research professor of psychology at Boston College. And he's also the author of Psychology and a book called Free to Learn, with the subtitle Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. He also writes a popular blog for Psychology Today magazine. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Very lovely to have you with us.
Okay. I'm very happy to be here.
And as usual, I'm also on the podcast. My name's Anthony Eldred-Rogers, and so I'm too delighted to welcome you, Peter, to this conversation we're going to have for the next 20 minutes, and then we're going to spend another 40 minutes looking a little more deeply into some of the topics.
And my name is Leila Eldridge. I didn't introduce myself,
didn't. Okay.
So here I am, Leila Eldridge.
Good. So, Peter, can I just kick us off here? Because, you know, when I looked at the title of the book, and again, your book, and again, when Leila read it out earlier on today, we were discussing our conversation. And the word unleash really stood out for me. And I'm curious, just to get us going, as to whether that your use of the word unleash implies that play needs unleashing in young human beings, or whether you're really referring to the fact that it's often squashed out of them and needs to be re-evoked.
Well, I think the word unleash, unleashing the instinct to play, I think what I'm trying to imply by that is that we don't need to encourage children to play. We certainly don't need to force children to play. We absolutely don't need to teach children how to play. Mm. All we have to do is let them play. Mm. And the reason we've seen this in terrible decline in children's play, especially outdoor play, over recent decades, in the United States especially, is because we've been leashing our children. We haven't been allowing them to get out there and play the way children are designed by nature to learn. This is how children are biologically designed to learn how to get along with other kids, how to solve their own problems, how to create their own adventures and survive them. All these things that children throughout history have learned away from adults in real children's play, and we've been leashing them. We've been preventing that.
In thinking about this, because you've done studies on unschoolers and how unschoolers turn out, I'm curious to know about what you think about unschoolers as adults. Do they seem to be more playful? So if you're freer as an adult and you have more time to play, I'm sorry, freer as a child and you have more time to play, how does that affect how an adult is?
So you're asking the question, if you've grown up as an unschooler in charge of your own education, are you more playful as an adult?
That's the question.
Yeah, I believe that's absolutely true. One of my research studies was a survey of 75 grown unschoolers. Mm-hmm. These were people ranging in age from 18 or 19 up to some in their in their 40s even, one or two, median age about 24 or 25. And I asked them a lot of questions about their adult lives, as well as about their memories of their childhood growing up in charge of their own education. And one of the things that came out of that study, which I think very much addresses the question that you are raising, is that they by and large see their work as play. They see their career as play. Their life is, in a certain sense, play. Why? Because during their childhood, during the time that they've been, that other kids have been in school required to do all these same things that everybody else is doing, they've been exploring and discovering their own passions in play. What do I really love to do? And then many of them have gone on to careers that are really direct extensions of what they played at. So So their way of making a living is still, in a very real sense, play. Mm. The other thing I found out is that they're less interested in making a lot of money, less interested in status than the typical young adult might be. They certainly want to be able to support themselves and their family if they have a family, and they certainly have proven they're capable of doing that. But they are most interested in living a life that they feel they're in charge of. And in some sense, that means a playful life, doing what they want to do, what they find to be meaningful. And it might be meaningful because it's doing good for the world, but it's the same. At the same time, it's fun for them because it's self-chosen. It's what they really want to do. They don't feel the way a lot of people in our society feel, that they're kind of victims of the society, that they have to do this or they have to do that. They really do have a much greater sense of being in charge of their destiny than other young people seem to have.
Peter, that's, I'm really interested in what you're saying here, because the one of the things that has been very much on my mind since we've had all this upheaval politically has been to wonder whether the way people relate to politics in their life is related to how they're brought up as children. And, I mean, joining some dots up here, do you think that the way that unschooled children, playful children, think about even something as serious as politics is different?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question. It's not something that I've studied specifically. I don't know, you know, what the typical political view is of that group of grown unschoolers that I studied. I do know that families involved in unschooling cross the whole spectrum in a certain sense. When we think sort of if we define sort of left wing and right wing in terms of the degree to which you believe that the government should be involved in decisions about people's lives in a certain sense, on that spectrum we find the whole range, although everybody's agreed that the government shouldn't be involved in how children become educated. Otherwise they would have chosen unschooling or self-directed education within the context of free and democratic schools. Other than that, but there's another dimension, and that's really the degree to which you are sort of attracted to authoritarian leaders. It's not insignificant, I think, that at the time of Hitler's Germany, Germany was the most schooled society in the world. And their schools at that time, not today so much, but at that time were very authoritarian. And I think a case can be made that that degree of schooling, that type of schooling, played a role in creating a citizenry that looked to a strong authoritarian leader as the way out of their problems. And of course, we all know the terrible, terrible consequences of that. And it's not too surprising to me that right now, in the United States and in Europe, we are seeing greater and greater attraction to authoritarian type leaders, certainly from in that category here in the United States. People are not so attracted to him because of any systematic policy he's giving out, because he hasn't given out any systematic policy. But they're attracted to him to the degree that they are because they see him as a strong leader, and we need a strong leader because we, the people, are not really capable of making our own proper decisions. And I think that could come out of the fact that, you know, this trend could come out of the fact that our schools have become ever more restrictive of young people's freedom. And we're now sort of seeing a generation of people who have grown up with less freedom and maybe are a little afraid of freedom, and maybe that attracts people to that kind of a leader.
Yeah.
It's a bit of speculation, I admit, but I don't think it's crazy idea.
No, yes, I mean, it's certainly something worth thinking about. I suppose in the general unschooling approach, it's very much more collaborative, and the idea really is to allow children to self-direct themselves, to make their own decisions, mm. to navigate their way through their own boredom, and in a way to allow them to be in their own kinds of crises, mm. and find their own way through them. And I think that's what you're pointing to.
Mm. Right.
Yeah. Can I just sort of take a quick step sort of into a different question for you, which is, I'm very curious as to why you have chosen, you know, this topic and this the unschooling field and so on to champion in your career and professionally.
Well, initially, as I tell the story at the beginning of my book, Free to Learn, about how I initially became involved with this, it had to do with my own son when he mm-hmm. was in the public school, 9 years old, but he'd mm-hmm. been sort of battling with his teachers throughout the whole period from kindergarten through fourth grade, and we were constantly being called in because he was very clearly rebelling against what he saw as restrictions on his freedom in school that didn't make any sense, and that mm-hmm. in fact were slowing down his learning. He was actually quite articulate even as a young child about mm-hmm. describing that. We at that time, I mean, this was a long time ago, back in the 1970s, late 1970s, and we at that time, his mother and I, you know, we didn't really see an alternative particularly, and it seemed to be a good school as schools go, and so we would try to get him to continue going on there. But I won't give away the story for people who I hope will read it in my book.
Don't.
Ultimately, he convinced us in a very dramatic fashion that he absolutely was not going to do this kind of prison-like school, absolutely not, and there was no way we were going to make him do it or anybody was going to make him do it. Mm-hmm. The result was we discovered a remarkable school not too far from where we were living called mm-hmm. the Sudbury Valley School. Already had been in existence for about a dozen years or so, and had and this was a school for self-directed education, a mm-hmm. place where there's no curriculum, there's no tests, nobody's making you do anything, but there's lots of opportunities to learn, and there are children there from age 4 through conventional high school age, not divided into grades, you interact as you please, all kinds mm-hmm. of things to do. The philosophy, absolutely the opposite of what most people think education has to be. Mm-hmm. We went out there for a visit, he immediately loved it. He said, this is how a school should be, if this is true. I was a little bit distrustful at the beginning. Is this really true? Mm-hmm. Am I seeing some kind of a show here? But once he was convinced it was true, to him, this was absolutely the way education should be occurring. There's lots of other kids to interact with. There's mm-hmm. lots to do. There's some very friendly and kindly adults there, not to make you do things you don't want to do, but to help you if you want help. mm-hmm. But I wasn't so convinced, right? I'm a professor. I was already a professor at Boston College. Mm-hmm. I was always a, quote, good student, end quote. You know, I kind of believed, and you know, although I had some questions about it, as many people do, I sort of believed in education as we usually conceive of it. So, and I was concerned about his future. So the result was that I ended up doing a study of the graduates of the school at that time. And this was way out of my normal realm of research. At that time, I was sort of a brain scientist. I was studying effects of certain hormones on the brains of rats and mice and happily doing that kind of research. And I ended up doing this study of the graduates of Sudbury mm-hmm. Valley School, publishing in the American Journal of Education. And the study absolutely convinced me that the school works as an educational setting. And that led me to then say, why does it work? How does it work? What's really happening here? had a graduate student who did his doctoral dissertation making observations there over many, many days about what's actually happening. Mm. And that's what led me really into a serious analysis of play, and especially play in an age-mixed environment where younger children and older children are interacting with one another. This is the way throughout history children have always played. It's only with age graded school that we've segregated children by age. So this really led me into the realm that is my passion now. I'm an evolutionary psychologist, meaning that I look at human behavior from a Darwinian perspective, from this perspective, I see that children come into the world biologically designed to educate themselves. And then the question to me is, how do they do that, and what are the supports in the environment that they need to do that well?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much, Peter. We're coming up, we've got about 4 minutes left on our first 20-minute or so segment. So just for those listeners who may not be able to stay on with us, can we just go to one of the hot potato topics, which is all about gaming and screen time and this relationship with technology? And as I'm sure you know, it's endlessly debated on the internet and between parents. And we have a sort of continuum on the left, which is, you know, no technology shall pass my child, you know, for the first 16 years.
Yeah.
And on the right, we have, you know, I just gave my 2-year-old an iPad and, you know, off you go. So just walk us through, if you can, where you stand on this, and give us, if you can, with the broad strokes. We'll go into it a little bit deeper in the next section. But
very good question, and it's an especially good question because many of the same people who agree with me on every other issue disagree with me on this one. I got interested in this question sort of as a result of the fact that when I give talks about the value of play and so on, oftentimes the first question asked is, because I tend to focus on outdoor play, because I see that as really what's missing among our children today. A very first question is, what do I think about computer play? What do I think about computer games? And I'm not a gamer myself, although I must say my son is, always has been, ever since he's had his own computer that he built himself back in the days when you built your computer kit, And even now, as a middle-aged adult, he's a computer gamer. So I've been on the periphery of it, but I never was although I've tried the games, I'm of an earlier generation, and I didn't grow up with them, and I haven't been drawn into them. Because I kept hearing all these stories about how terrible video games are, how the violent video games cause violence, how they rot your mind, how they create obesity and social isolation and deprive you of sleep and are addictive and all of these kinds of things that you read about, I began to ask, well, what's the research evidence on this? You know, it's one thing to tell individual stories. You can make whatever case you want with individual stories. I mean, there are millions and millions of video game players, and some of them are no doubt crazy, and some of them are no doubt obese, and some of them are no doubt socially isolated, but that's also true of the millions and millions who don't play video games. So the individual stories that people tend to use as their evidence are not convincing scientific evidence. So there is a certain amount of research, and what surprised me in a certain sense when I really looked at systematic research is that none of these claims have any serious research support for them. And in fact, many of the studies that I think were initially designed to on the hypothesis that these myths about, so I'll use the word myths, about the negative effects of video games are true, I think found contradictory evidence. You know, one major study found the only study that has looked at violence, real world violence, correlated with video gameplay, found no correlation at all. And in fact found that there's a strong correlation, not surprisingly, between the likelihood of a young person becoming violent at some point in the real world or getting into trouble for fighting or in school or that kind of thing, the likelihood of that is very strongly correlated with real world violence in your home. If your dad beats your mom, you're likely to grow up being violent. But if you play violent video games, that has, according to this really best study, as far as I can see, that's been done, that has zero effect on, even zero correlation with whether or not you're violent in the real world. There are other studies looking at social isolation, and lo and behold, the kids who play video games have more friends than those who don't. In a way, not surprisingly, because many of the video games are social. This is what kids are talking about with each other. This is the culture of today, and if you're not doing it, you may well be left out of the culture of today. The business about having it having negative effects on your growth of your mind, this, all the research, that all the serious research that's been done shows the exact opposite. In fact, there's research, including well-done experimental research, showing that all kinds of cognitive abilities actually increase when you play video games. You do studies where with people who don't play video games, and you assign half of them to play a certain kind of video game over a period of time. You then test them on a battery of standard cognitive tests, and on some of those tests you find significant improvement, including some of the same kinds of tests that are used on standard IQ tests. You find significant improvement as a result of playing video games. So, although I think that video game play can be a time management problem, a lot of the things that we enjoy doing, we maybe do more than we really would want to do. And so sometimes I think, just regardless of whatever you're involved in, you might want to think about, if you're a kid or if you're an adult, because the same applies for adults, you might want to think about ways of putting some breaks on the amount of time you're spending on this, so you're not depriving your friends and loved ones and relatives, you know, and your friends of your time, and you're not preventing yourself from developing some of the other aspects of your being.
Right. And I just like to pick that thread up a little more, because earlier on you were talking about, you know, outdoor play. In, you know, you mentioned a couple of times, you know, being outdoors and I presume in nature in some way. Do you, is there a sort of tension between the two that needs managing?
Well, that's interesting. There's a study, I do have a blog, three blog posts on this for people who are interested in this on my Psychology Today blog. And if you look at the table of contents page, you can find one relatively recent post on that and a couple of posts that are two or three years old. And so you can see the actual studies there. But here's the interesting point about outdoor play. The studies that have been done show that doesn't seem to be a trade-off on average between video game play and outdoor play. More or less everybody today is being deprived of outdoor play, and that's something we can talk about in more detail in the second part of this segment as to why. But the kids who are playing video games, if anything, are outdoors playing more than the kids who are not playing video games. What they're doing less of is watching television less. So there seems to be a trade-off between playing video games, this active kind of thing on the screens, versus the somewhat more passive thing of sitting and watching television. The same kind of kids who do a lot of video gaming like to be active, apparently, and they also like to be active outdoors when they have the opportunity to do it. When they are in an environment where they are truly allowed to go outdoors without adults telling them what to do all the time, because kids hate that, right? And where they really have the opportunity to play with other kids, there doesn't seem to be a trade-off. An example of this is at the Sudbury Valley School, the school that I told you about earlier on, where my son went. Kids can, in theory, play video games all day long there, and some do a lot of video gaming, but the great majority, there's a real balance. They're playing outdoors, they're climbing on the rocks, they're fishing, they're exploring in the woods, they're having all kinds of outdoor adventures, they're creating pickup games of soccer and touch football and so on. And they are also doing video play. And they do both because there are kids to play with. And exactly. There are kids who want them to come out and play with them. So that's the solution. That's the solution. If we, you know, so many people, they've already deprived their kids of outdoor play. They might not admit it, but they've deprived their kids of outdoor play because they're afraid to let their kids go out and play without adult supervision. Right. And then they see the kids on the computer. Well, where else the kids can play? Now they deprive them of that. And they're depriving their kids of all play.
There's some interesting also blending going on, because there's some educational technology available on, you know, iPads and smartphones that kids are being encouraged to take outdoors and, you know, do things like point them at flowers and point them at trees and so on. And there's it's kind of interesting that the two are slightly coming together as well in that respect, which I don't know if you come across.
Yes,
that.
It is. I think it's great to see that happening. You know, Pokemon Go, I think, is
right.
It's, you know, it's very comparable to bird watching. You know, if you think about it.
It is. Peter, thank you very much. We're going to just take a pause now for those listeners who, if you like, have to go, and we're going to come back for those of you listening in just one moment and dig a little deeper into some of the topics that we've touched on. Okay, everybody, welcome back, and we're here talking with Professor Peter Gray, and we're going to dig into some of the topics that we've touched on in the first 20 minutes, and let's do that now. We're going to kick off with Layla's question about, is all play equal?
Yeah, Peter, there's something that I wanted to ask, because, you know, this is a question as a mother. So when I see my son gaming on a computer, instinctively, I'm really happy for him because I can see that he's learning and he's enjoying himself and he's happy and he's playing. But there's that part of me that seems to be happier when I see him running through the fields or up a tree or swimming in the sea or doing something outdoors. So, and I know I'm biased towards the latter, being outside, the outdoor. So I'm curious to know, is all play equal? What's going on in the brain?
Yeah, that's a great question. And allow me to slightly reword the question. Is all play the same?
Right? Right, yeah.
And play, there's a lot of different ways of playing, and play is not necessarily accompanied by laughter and smiling. Play can be very intense and very serious. It draws you in. You might not look like you are playing, but if it's self-chosen and you're immersed in it and you are fully involved in it, it is play. So there's some kinds of play, you know, playing chess. Playing a difficult computer game, playing for Einstein, solving mathematical problems, which he always called play. I don't think you would have seen him looking joyful, but he nevertheless would call that play. He's mentally turning things around. He's play, even, you know, it, and sometimes it gets hard, but you like the hard part because this is the challenge. You're trying to solve this challenge. So I think that there's a very big difference in this between the kind of play when you're joyfully running around outdoors and doing those kinds of things, although outdoor play can sometimes be intense too. You can be very intense on climbing that tree to a higher branch, you know, and really working at it, and you're not necessarily smiling and laughing while you're doing that. But I think that that's something we have to understand, that play can look very serious, and in a certain sense, in certain definition, it is very serious. The distinction between what's play and non-play is whether it's self-chosen and whether this is really what you yourself want to do and you are in control of it. Nobody else is telling you how to do it or what exactly to do. Now, I do, I have the same bias that you do, Lila. I love the outdoors, and I grew up playing outdoors much more than indoors, although I always knew people who preferred indoor play. You know, there weren't computer play around at that time, but people who who engaged in all kinds of games and card games and so on, although I certainly did a lot of that too. But I do think it's really valuable to play outdoors, but I also think it's really valuable, especially in this day and age, to play on computers.
Mm.
So that's why I think that our job as parents, our job as a society, as adults in general, should not be to restrict the menu even further of how children can play, but to expand that menu. To make it really attractive for kids to go out inside and play. And attractive really means not any adults there telling them what to do. Maybe if you feel you need an adult out there kind of as a lifeguard to make sure nothing terrible happens, and you've got an adult who's not going to intervene all the time, who's not going to settle every little quarrel that happens, who's not going to get excited because somebody skinned their knee, but is just going to let people play but be kind of a guard against anything truly horrid happening, that's probably okay as long as that adult doesn't make himself or herself too conspicuous or too available for tattling and all those kinds of things that kids are inclined to use adults for these days. That's okay, but we have to understand that kids want to play away from adults and they want to play with other kids, and unless we provide that opportunity, they're not going to be playing outdoors much.
Peter, this is fascinating. So what you're saying, and I just want to make sure I'm not misquoting you here, you said just now any activity that is a child has freely chosen could be called play or ought to be called plays. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I actually have, in my book and other writing, I actually have a five-part definition of play. Let me just very, very briefly list it. If an activity is fully play, if it has these components, first, that it's self-chosen and self-directed. You are deciding to do it, and you are deciding how to do it. Now, that could be still a game, even like chess, where there are clear rules, but you are choosing to follow those rules. You are entering the game and recognizing these are the rules. This is me making this decision to do it. Nobody else making me do it this way. Mm. Within the game, you are making all the decisions, even if you're following within the boundary of the rules. So that's where I would say that Little League game of baseball, where a coach is making the decisions as to who's playing what position and whether it's time to bunt now or swing away and all of this kind of stuff, a coach is telling you what to do within the boundaries of the game, I would say is not play. But a pickup game of baseball where you're following the rules of baseball, but you're also free to change those rules if you can convince other people. You're sort of creating the rules. You're creating the game in a certain sense. And within the boundaries of those rules, each individual is deciding for themselves how they're going to play. Am I going to swing away? Am I going to bunt? Am I going to pitch hard or soft to this kid who's batting now? And so on. So that's the most important part of the definition, freely chosen and self-directed. The other parts of the definition include the following, that you're doing it for its own sake. You're not doing it primarily for some reward outside of the game itself. You're not doing it to get an A on a report card or a gold star or a trophy or praise from your parents or to get physically fit. You're not doing it primarily for that reason. You're doing it just because it's fun to do.
So it's intrinsically motivated.
Yeah, it's intrinsically motivated as opposed to extrinsically motivated.
Right.
Third characteristic, and this is one that surprises a lot of people, but when you think about it, I think you'll recognize why this is true. All play involves rules. It's never random activity. It's never, you know, if you're playing with blocks, you're not just randomly piling up the blocks. You're creating something. You've got some sense of what you're doing. You've got a set of rules in your mind. I'm trying to create a castle, or I'm trying to create a fortress, or whatever it is you're building. If you're playing an imaginative game with your friends, imagine four-year-olds playing a game of house or superheroes, the rule is you have to stay in character, and your playmate will remind you have to stay in character if you get out of character. And even in a rough and tumble game, a play fight, there are the difference between a play fight and a real fight is the play fight has rules. They may not be spoken, but if you violate one of those rules, your playmate will quickly remind you.
Right.
You can't kick, you can't bite, you can't scratch, you can't really hurt the other person. If you're the stronger of the two, you have to self-handicap in some way to make it even and fun for both of you. So I could go through every kind of play imaginable and tell you how there are rules for that play. So one of the things children are learning in play is how to restrain themselves, how to follow rules. Very important life lesson. A fourth characteristic of play is that all play involves an element of imagination. Every kind of play, the players recognize this is a step outside of the real world. We are now in an imaginary world. This is an imaginary world if it's chess, where bishops can only move on the diagonal. If it's baseball, where to get home you have to run around those bases, where, you know, every if there are formal rules, the imagination is the flip side of those rules. But there's also imagination because there's always creativity in play. What you have to think about within the realm of potential movements, what would I imagine would be the consequence of doing this? So you're thinking in this sort of hypothetical way all the time in play. In the that kind of truly, fully imaginative play that little children commonly play, or that older children play when they're playing many of the video games that involve involve an imaginary world and helping to create your own imaginary world. This is real imagination. You are creating a narrative, and you are creating a character, and you are following through on that creation. So, and then the fifth characteristic, which kind of follows naturally from the others, is that play involves a state of mind in which the person is not stressed, at least not highly stressed. There may be a certain amount of stress involved for that girl who's playing at climbing the tree and trying to go as hard as she can go, and she's inducing a little bit of fear in herself. But ultimately, if the fear becomes too great, if the stress becomes too great, you can just come down from the tree. Nobody's making you do it. So the result is one of the characteristics of free, which follows from that first characteristic I mentioned and is really a correlate of it, is that you're always free to quit.
Right.
And because you're always free to quit, you're never in a highly stressed position. If you get into that highly stressed position, you just quit. I'm not having fun anymore. I'm going home. So the consequence, so that means your mind is active, because you have to have an active mind in play. You have to be immersed in it, because you're following these rules. You have to pay attention to what you're doing. And these are rules of the mind. These are rules coming out of your own head. But you're not highly stressed. This is a state of mind that psychologists often refer to as flow. And this is the state of mind that a lot of research has shown is the best state of mind for learning new skills, for being creative, for thinking outside of the box. And you are in that state of flow when you're playing a video game. You are in that state of flow when you're climbing trees outdoors. You're in that state of flow when you are intensely involved in any kind of play.
Peter, really interesting, and thank you for taking us through that. Can I link this back to outdoor play? Because I notice you in these five things, you haven't one of the requirements doesn't mandate that this all takes place outdoors. So what is it about, why do we use the word outdoor play, and what are we trying to differentiate between by using it?
Yeah, I think that when I was growing up, what outdoor play meant, and what outdoor play meant throughout most of history, throughout most of history, most of us were outdoors most of the time. So the outdoors was our natural environment. I mean, hunter-gatherers lived in, they built little huts and they slept in those huts, but they wouldn't spend their time during the day sitting in those huts, right? And even when I was a kid in the 1950s, we had small houses and we had fairly big families, and we didn't want to be crowded into that house with all our siblings, and certainly our moms didn't want us in there, right? They wanted us out of the house. I mean, the the refrain of every mother was, Get out of the house. Stop bothering.
Yeah.
Interestingly, now the refrain is the exact opposite.
Yeah, right?
And don't go out. It's too dangerous out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that was the way, you know, so outdoors was where we played because that's where we lived, except when we were when we were eating dinner or sleeping or doing housework or, you know, we had a little bit of indoor play and we did a little bit of reading, but and in school even, you know, recesses were always outdoors and recesses were much longer than they are today and so on. So the outdoors was where kids were.
Right. So
the other thing about outdoors and why kids wanted to be outdoors is that's where you got, just as the moms wanted to get the kids out of their hair, the kids want to get away from their moms. They don't want their moms telling them what to do. They don't want other adults telling them what to do. So you could find other kids and you could find play outdoors, and you could play in your own ways. All these things that I'm describing about play, you could do outdoors, and you might not be able to do it so well indoors because you might have some adult hovering around you, telling you what to do, or criticizing you, or even praising you. Kids don't want to get praise. they want because praise is sort of the flip side of criticism. You know, it's like it's an expression of control, an expression, oh, you're doing what I want you to do now, so I'm going to tell you, good boy, good girl, right?
Yeah.
So kids want to get away from that.
Right. What's your view, Peter?
So now we have this idea, which I don't entirely agree with, but I partly agree with, that the outdoors for its own sake, just because it's the great and wonderful outdoors, it's the place of nature, that's where kids should be because they should love the great outdoors. And I kind of agree with that. I do love the great outdoors. Why do I love it? It's because I grew up outdoors. I grew up playing outdoors. When I was a kid, I wasn't going outdoors to watch the birds or to admire the trees or to listen to the babbling brook. I was going outdoors to play with my friends. Incidentally, as a result of being outdoors, I grew to love these things about the outdoors, and now I'll go outdoors just for its own sake. But if we think we're going to get kids outdoors just to watch the birds and listen to the babbling brook because we think that's a healthy thing to do, that's not going to work for most kids. It might work for some. Some kids are naturally attracted to that, and we can't stop them from doing it as long as we don't, you know, leash them, to go back to that word, leashing.
Right.
But most kids, if they have the choice between just going outdoors and listening to the babbling brook or playing on the computer with their friends, they're going to play on the computer with their friends.
Yeah.
Mm. Peter, you may be familiar with this sort of trend to have these indoor warehouses that are so-called play zones, you know, and families go into them, you know, with the parents and the mums, and the kids are inside a sort of big air-conditioned unit with lots of set-up activities. What's your feeling about that? Do they tick the boxes of play?
Well, you know, I think it really depends on what happens in there. You know, I always worry when it's set up so the parents are there too. I have not observed that kind of setting. Maybe the closest thing I've observed, there were a number of years, a member of the Unitarian Church, and in our church every year around Christmas time we would have a kind of do-it-yourself family opportunity to create Christmas ornaments and create little toys and so on. So we would have this set up where, you know, you might call it maker space, to use today's terminology, where we had sort of the tools and we had glue guns and so on, and people could create things. And I was one of the organizers of that. And one of the observations I made was there were sort of two classes of parents in this. There were some parents who were scooting their kids around and watching over their kids and telling them, oh, be really careful with that glue gun, and oh, you're doing it wrong, let me show you how to do it right, and so on and so forth. And they might even be doing it in the most friendly seeming way, let me help you, but they might also be kind of motivated to make sure that their kids did all the activities rather than just bury themselves in one of them. And that, to me, I hated watching that. That, to me, was ruining the children's play. And I've seen that happen in museums where adults, the kids get fascinated by something, but the adults kind of want to, for some kind of educational reason, move them along and show them everything. So then there was the other parent, which I have to say was a bit more rare, who would just let the kids go. And I happened to be at the table where there were these hot glue guns, and I actually wrote a blog post, one of my early blog posts on this, and there was this little kid, I don't know how old he was, maybe four, who was making this wonderfully carefully crafted creation in which he had a huge pine cone and he was gluing a tiny little bean onto every little lobe of the pine cone. And I was so happy that his parents were not paying any attention to it. And whenever somebody else tried to interrupt him, I said, no, let him be. Don't disrupt him. And fortunately, they didn't disrupt him. One woman, a well-meaning woman, asked me, don't you think it's dangerous for such a little child to use a hot glue gun? He might burn himself. And I said, you know, look at him. He's being more careful than anybody else at this table. He's being so careful. And if we were to tell him to be careful, we would be interrupting his concentration, and we'd be saying something he doesn't need to hear. He already knows this. So that's the, to me, whether or not it's play doesn't have to do with what you've set up, although setting a lot of great stuff up for play is terrific. But whether you are truly letting the kids play, as opposed to trying to think of this as some kind of an educational experience that you are going to help them with.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Peter, can I ask you then, you've talked a lot about play. So what happens when the child's play is constantly controlled? We've talked about the benefits of play.
It's not play anymore.
What kind of adult does that make? You know,
what's
the impact?
Well, the impact is, I think, what we're seeing today. What we are seeing today, and there's a lot of evidence of this, is many young adults growing up not really knowing how to create their own activities, not really knowing how to solve their own problems. And these include all kinds of problems, including emotional problems, and maybe especially emotional problems. Because part of what's happening in play is you're getting into difficulties. You're getting lost and getting frightened and then finding your way home. You are bullied in some minor way, and you get angry and upset. But if you are truly out there without an adult telling you what to do, you figure out how to handle it. You figure out, what am I going to do about this? Does this mean I just avoid this person? Can I confront this person in some way? You figure it out. When you've got an adult there solving all your problems, when you've got an adult sort of guiding you through an activity, you don't learn how to guide yourself through your own activity. So what we're finding now, and this is, and again, I have a blog post on this, is there's more and more recognition on college campuses that many college students are coming without the ability to solve problems that we used to be able to take for granted that young adults could solve: roommate problems, breakup problems, you know, and they're having mental breakdowns about it and going to the counselors about it. In addition, we're finding more and more, the professors are saying more and more, you know, I used to be able to just assign an essay. I would say, you know, one of the jobs is that you write an essay on some topic of your choosing that's related to this course, and you'll be graded on this essay. And so this is a kind of a creative activity. You have to figure out what you want to write about. You have to create how you're going to write about it. And what professors are finding now is if they give such an assignment, students are very upset about that. They want to be told what the topic should be. They want to be told exactly how to write the essay. They want to have feedback all along the way that tells them how to do it. And I attribute this partly to the change in how we do schooling. We're no longer asking kids to do creative things at all in school, or at least not as much as we used to in school. We're asking them to do very structured things that the teacher's structuring for them. But in addition, even more so, I attribute it to the decline of play. Play mm-hmm. always requires that you be creative, always requires that you structure your own activity and follow it through. And now you've got kids who don't know how to do that. Young adults who mm-hmm. don't know how to do it. We're hearing more and more from the workplace, people who are hiring new college graduates, that even at that point they're saying, I used to be able to give new employees a job and they would figure out how to do it. Mm-hmm. Now I have to tell them step by step how to do it because they don't feel they can figure out how to do it.
So Peter, can I jump in here because we've got about 6 minutes left or so. One of the things I really want to touch on is this issue of automation. Now, recently there's been some press, you may have seen it from various people. One of them was Art Bilger from Wharton Business School. And there's a lot of concern at the moment about automation, you know, taking jobs out of the economy. And I think, you know, there's various figures around, but they're pretty alarming. Some say up to 40% of all jobs are going to go within the next, you know, 2 decades. So one of the things that I think is interesting, and this links back to what you've just been saying, is do you think that parents who are pursuing these, you know, this unschooling alternative view of encouraging self-directed learning, supporting play and so on, are actually doing their children a favor in terms of this future context? Are they going to end up having an advantage?
Yeah, I definitely think they're going to end up having an advantage. And I think we're already seeing some of the evidence of that. The study I did of grown-on schoolers showed that, you know, they're finding jobs. I said earlier that they were pursuing often in their careers jobs that were pretty much direct extensions of their realms of play. And they're creating jobs that most people would never think of as jobs, sort of non-standard jobs. Many of them are becoming entrepreneurs. They're creating things and selling them, or here's one example. There was a young man who grew up with, this happened to be a person who did grow up with an absolute love of the outdoors and nature, mm-hmm. and he also loved the idea of flying. He got into gliding, gliding even as a teenager, and then he got in, as he earned a little money and was able to afford to do it, he took flying lessons, and he also discovered he loved to photograph nature. So now he's got a great job that he created as an aerial nature photographer. So he's combining all of his loves, nature, flying, photography. That's just one example. It's kind of an exotic example, but I could give many more examples. So people finding ways of making a living. The other thing that I think is relevant to this issue of automation and loss of jobs is, you know, if you have grown up not playing, if you have grown up sort of feeling like life is work, which school tends to teach you to do, the important thing for the child in school increasingly today is that you work hard at school, you do well in school, you suppress your own interests and do what you're supposed to do, that modality of school made some sense in a way back in the days when jobs were really boring, assembly line jobs, you know, bureaucracy jobs, where the job is to just do this tedious paperwork or physical work that you have to do over and over and over again the same thing, and you have to keep your nose to the grindstone, as they say. And if you grew up that way, it's hard to know what you would do if you had a lot of free time, you know. Right. And so you grew up thinking that life is work, and if you were to lose your job or didn't need a job, what would you do? You'd be depressed. I think that kids who are growing up playing, they would love the idea of a world with fewer work hours. They wouldn't be any less active. They would not, and they might not be any less productive. They might even be contributing more to society because now they're not doing it just for money. They're doing it for meaning in life, for fun in life, for making connections with other people, for the sense of helping the world. And I see those things playing a big role in the lives of grown unschoolers and grown Sudbury Valley students as well. And so I think that if we had that kind, we would have a, you know, here's the irony in a way. You know, back in the 1930s, John Maynard Keynes and many other people predicted that by the end of the century, and certainly by this time in the 21st century, we wouldn't be having to work very hard. Mm-hmm. Automation would take over our work, and so we would have the luxury of lots of time, lots of free time to play and do the things that we want to do and that make us human. That hasn't happened. You know, we have the potential for that to happen because most people are not doing work that really is necessary. You know, they're not producing food or clothing or housing. Most people are doing work that we could eliminate and it wouldn't reduce anybody's well-being except for the fact it takes a salary away. So the problem right now is that we haven't created an economic system that has caught up with our ability for technology to reduce the amount of work. So we have to keep creating jobs somehow, and we even create jobs that are harmful. I mean, you see, you know, politicians from both sides of the aisle will fight hard to keep a munitions factory in their state, even when the army says we don't need those munitions. We don't need them. So here you are, you're creating weapons that you don't need. Or you have people arguing, let's keep the coal mines open because we'll lose jobs otherwise, even though everybody acknowledges that the coal mine jobs are terrible jobs in terms of people's health. Yeah. Let's keep the factories going, even though we know that the pollution from the factory is harmful, and we don't need those things the factory is producing. You know, we've got better ways of doing things. Mm. So we've got this crazy world where, for the sake of jobs, we are doing things that are actually harmful, if and at minimal are unnecessary, just so people can make a living. We've got to figure out some other way of distributing the wealth. And I know that sounds radical and that scares people off, but unless we find some other way of, you know, creating a world, and we have a world where in theory all of us would only have to work about 15 to 20 hours a week to do all the things that are necessary. At most, that's all we would have to work for us to create the wealth to support everybody in the world. but we haven't figured out how to distribute that except through the 40-hour a week or more job.
So, Peter, if you kind of could give one message to, you know, parents out there with, you know, youngish children, you know, what would it be? What would your call to action for them be?
Well, my call to action would be to learn how to trust your children's instincts and judgments. Don't see parenting as a battle of will between you and your child. Listen to your child. Pay attention to what your child wants and may need. Help your child do what your child wants and needs rather than fight your child. There are some times, of course, when you want to counsel your child, you want to sit down and talk with your child. You should never hold back from describing your own point of views about things. That makes you a real person to your child. But treat your child as a real person. Children are far more capable, far smarter, far more understanding of their own abilities and needs than we give them credit for. Mm-hmm. And our role as a parent is not to shape our children into who they ultimately will be. Our role as parents is to learn who our children are. They're strangers who've entered into our home. And our job is to figure out, is to kind of observe them, figure out who they are, help them along the way to be who they want to be, and forget the idea that we should try to shape them into who we want them to be, because that's the setup for a fight.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's Peter, it's wonderful listening to you. I have one more question. and changing the topic a little bit, would you talk to me about the Alliance for Self-Directed Education? Could you talk a little bit about that quickly?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that question. I'm very excited about this. The Alliance for Self-Directed Education is an organization that I'm involved with, and a number of other people helped to organize it. We're kind of in an early phase with it. We've launched a website, which you can find, self-directed.com with a, or self-directed.org rather, with a dash between the self, a hyphen between the self and directed, or just Google Alliance for Self-Directed Education. What we're trying to do with the Alliance is really help to stimulate a movement. There are many, many people involved with self-directed education. There's an estimated 200,000 children who are unschoolers in the United States right now. There are many, many families sending their children to schools similar to that Sudbury Valley school that I mentioned, where it's set up for self-directed education. But to a good degree, the people involved with this are not well connected with others involved with it and don't necessarily see it as part of a national movement. And we want to turn this into a movement. I almost see it as analogous to the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s in the United States, or the feminist movement that followed, where there was a widespread recognition that there's a class of people who are not being given the full rights that we can assume to be the rights of human beings. And right now, the class of people who, in fact, are being increasingly deprived of rights rather than being granted rights are children. And especially in the context of schools. So I see this as analogous to that, those movements. And I really see the people who are already involved in self-directed education, who see how beautifully it works. I see these people as potential spokespeople for this movement, for bringing more freedom to children. Certainly in this country, we're especially focused in the United States and North America, but to some degree we're an international group too, because these problems that I've been talking about are international. So we call it an alliance because we see all the people who are involved in self-directed education, who are interested in it, who want to create more freedom for children as allies in this movement. We're encouraging people. We will soon be at a stage where it's possible to go to that website and become a member. And then we're going to have local chapters, we hope, of the Alliance for Self-Directed Education. And these local chapters will play roles in their local communities to help counsel parents who are interested in self-directed education but a little afraid of it and might need some help, help create play groups for kids who are involved in self-directed education, all kinds of great opportunities. But we're just now in a formative stage, and I would love it if listeners who are interested would come to that website, and once we've got the membership opportunities available, would consider becoming a member of the Alliance.
Well, very exciting, Peter, and we certainly want to be involved and plan to be. So for anyone who wants to get in touch, we're going to put all the details, indeed, of your blogs and your websites below this podcast. So for those of you listening, just look on the page and you're going to see all the resources that are available from Peter. Peter, we've gone over time, so and I have a sense we could just really keep going. There's so much more we could talk about, but for this session, thank you so very much for your enlightening input. And Leila has got some observation goats.
No, I just want to thank you very much. It's been great listening to you talk and hearing your wonderful words. So I want to say a big thank you very much. It's been wonderful. I also want to mention something completely arbitrary. Where we are right now, we're in Spain, and 850 goats are outside our window with bells on their necks. So if throughout the podcast, whilst you've been listening, you've been hearing meh, meh, and bells ringing, it's the goats. Okay. So, but a big thank you very, very much. It was a wonderful, wonderful podcast. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. And again, thank you all. Thank you for what you both are doing and for being allies in this movie.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, maybe we can close on just, you know, we have three children. They are in their early teens, our daughters. And so much of what we've talked about in this podcast is absolutely true. And for anyone listening, Peter, your inspirational words, I hope, has called them to feel confident about it. But our experience, too, as parents, is the best decision we ever made. And it is truly a wonderful thing to see. So I encourage everyone to take a look at it. Thank all of you listening. And thank you very much, Peter.
Very welcome.